Good morning. Nice to see you on a finally warm spring day and on Earth Day. For those of you that I haven't met, my name is Fusho, and I'm a senior student here at the Village Zendo. I brought this really beautiful wood block print or carving that Kancho made. He's another senior student here, but he made this, he gave it to me after he became a senior student. So it's this Enso that we see so often everywhere in Zen. And I brought it because I wanted to talk about this koan that's translated as the symbol of the circle. It's been making me think about this saying that we use a lot, which is the other side of the coin, or the flip side. And so in the Blue Cliff Record, the koan's called Ministry President Chen Sao Si Tzu Fu, or the symbol of the circle. So Chen Sao, ministry president, went to see Tzu Fu. And when Fu saw him coming, he immediately drew a circle. And Sao said, "My coming here like this has already missed the point. How much more so to go on and draw a circle?" And Sao thereupon closed the door of his room. And Sui Tu said, "Chen Sao has just one eye." So the ministry president, Chen Sao, he was a lay person. He wasn't a formal a monk or anything, formal student. But he was known to be very enlightened, I guess, lay person, who studied very seriously and had some understanding of the way. And so Master Fu knew this about him. And when he saw him coming, you know, he didn't say anything to him. He just drew the circle. And it's this circle in Zen that has so much symbolism of the absolute, or oneness, or wholeness, or you could say emptiness, which is, you know, the wholeness that is everything, or including everything. And so I think that the ministry president recognized the symbol that there's, you know, there is nothing else. This is all there is. Or for me, there's nothing outside the circle. And responded, "Well, since everything's included and there is nothing else, there's nothing to know, nothing to learn, I shouldn't even have come to see you, obviously. So in that case, why would you even bother to draw the circle?" And then the master, so they have this sort of call and response. And then the master, responding to that, just closed the door on him. Because there's nothing left to be said. And something about the image of the circle and then the closing of the door, it just made me start to think about the idea of nothing outside the circle. And what else, you know, what else is there to say? But I think the exchange appealed to me because there's not a lot of talking. But they're clearly communicating without these too many words. So the verse for the koan goes like this. "Round and round the pearls go round, ringing like jade. Horses carry it, asses bear it, loaded on an iron ship. Share it with an unconcerned traveler of sea and mountain. When fishing for a tortoise, he lets down a cage trap." Sui Tu also said, "No patch-robed monk in the world can jump out." And I think the verse points to the fact that we find these circles in our life no matter where we look. There was a nice commentary from Zen Master Hakuin on the verse. He says, "The roundness and reverberation of the pearl versify the circle. The whole world is one. All conscious beings, both male and female, are perfect jewels. This is called the infinity of interdependent relations, absorption in the precious mirror, and absorption in interaction. But he also says, do not understand this line in terms of the realm of the absolute in itself, which I think means it also includes the relative. It's both. And we have to have both in this world. And what does that mean in our daily lives? I certainly have things that I prefer not to include in my circle. I have very strong opinions about bad and good and what I like and don't like, what's the wrong way and the right way to do something. I wanted to talk also about, you know, on Earth Day, a great example of nothing outside the circle. You know, the effects of global warming and pollution. So a literal example would be this whale that washed up on shore and died recently. It was a sperm whale. I think it was in Spain. And they didn't know what happened. It just it didn't look hurt. They didn't know why it had died. So scientists cut it open, and they found 64 pounds of plastic in its stomach, just plastic that it had eaten, you know, in the ocean, that was floating around in the ocean. Because, what, you know, it didn't recognize it as food, because why would something in the ocean not be food? It's a pretty visceral example of everything being connected, I think. And it's a warning sign. You know, I saw an image of it online from Spain in the newspaper, but we can see this image around the world now, and we didn't used to be able to do that. So it is a wake-up call in a way that it can be alarming and people can respond to and recognize maybe we shouldn't put our plastic in the ocean or let it get into the ocean. You know, I don't know why it takes something so dramatic to be the wake-up call, but I think we all have those moments in our life where something happens that we say, oh, that woke me up. I was thinking about how this practice, actually, for me, has, over the long term, been kind of a wake-up call. But I was going to tell this story. I wanted to tell a story about a time that I was driving with my, he was my fiance. We were dating. I guess he's my fiance. I'd fallen in love with him, but it was still kind of early. We were in Colorado, and we were going up to meet some of his family. It was an overpass up in the mountains. We're going up to the ski resort, and there was a storm, and the roads were really icy and really snowy. And I grew up in Colorado. I grew up in the mountains, driving four-wheel drive vehicles, and not intimidated to drive at all on mountain roads. But I was also sort of coming to the end of a period of my life where I was very sort of destructive and not very attentive. And so I was a super confident driver, and I was kind of showing off a little bit. I'm not afraid of icy roads, I got this, you know, no problem. So we were driving, I was going too fast, and the roads were pretty bad, you know, and so I think we went around a curve, and I just braked, because somebody in front of me hit the brakes, and we skidded off towards the other, you know, towards the edge of this cliff, kind of the mountainside dropped off. I completely lost control of the car, and we just ended up in a snowbank. Luckily, if there hadn't been a snowbank, it was a lot of snow, and if there hadn't been a snowbank, that would have been it. We would have been off for sure. It just cushioned us, so we were fine. We had to get the car towed out of the snowbank, but it was a wake-up call for me. You know, my now husband, he sort of, after we realized we were okay, and later on that weekend, he said, he kind of pulled me aside and said, you know, I need you to stick around. He knew what was going on. He was like, I really need you here. And for whatever reason, the conditions were right, and I just suddenly realized, like, don't be so reckless, pay attention. I really wanted him to be in my life also. This was like a great thing. And so I slowed down, and now I pay a lot more attention on the roads. So that was the result of that near-death experience. And I think that can obviously help us appreciate our life when we almost die. That's an opportunity to respond. But I also think that this practice can be that without such dramatic consequence on the cushion. You know, it's natural that the most difficult things invoke the strongest responses. And I think that's just part of life. And I think there's something to this. Can't have the good without the bad, or the black without the white, and the darkness without the light. It's just that we don't always know what the other side is. We can't predict that. But I think if we sit and allow space around whatever thing we might not want to look at too closely, or we might be resisting or avoiding, that can help shift. And the answer might not be what we initially thought it was. You know, there's a lot of people that are asking, would we have this Me Too moment right now if Trump hadn't been elected, for example? Or would we have, you know, Time's Up? If Hillary had been elected, would we have thought everything is great? We've made a lot of progress and just kept on going the way we were? Would we have stopped and really examined the way women are still treated? I don't know. I'm not sure. There was a story in the New York Times about the fact that because of Trump being elected, the Equal Rights Amendment might actually be ratified. It's only taken over 100 years. It's not a law. It's not in the Constitution that women are protected as equal members of society. Still, I'm not sure we would have really thought about that if Hillary had been elected, or the way men still treat women. Would we have been examining that so closely as we are right now? I have a cousin, and she's a really dear friend, and she comes from a family that suffers from really severe depression. It's in her genes. And her brother committed suicide. And she tells people that it was one of the darkest times of her life. One of the worst things that ever happened to her. And she became depressed, but she also, after this happened, she put herself through some intensive psychotherapy and really started to look inward and examine her own life and work with herself. And so she says, that was the worst thing that ever happened to me, but I also think it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because if he hadn't died in that way, she might not have ever examined her own life. The way it affected her was something she couldn't have predicted. And, you know, it gave her a lot of value to her own life. Not in an easy, comfortable way or a way that she might have hoped for, but that was the cause and effect of that for her. Sometimes I think when we look around and say, times are so terrible, they are terrible. They are. The world does feel like it's on fire. Has there ever been a time when someone somewhere didn't feel like the world was on fire? I'm not sure. I think maybe it's always been on fire. You know, I think that when we acknowledge this sort of the darkness or this simple fact that we are going to die, that's what gives us this appreciation for our life. How would we know how to appreciate our life if we didn't know we were going to die? How do we respond to that reality and that fact, I think, is how we shape our lives and how we decide to live it to the fullest. Or if we're going to live in fear and reject the other half of the coin, then we'll push it away. Or sometimes we'll cling too tightly to that fact and we'll wallow in it and be paralyzed. But I think just sitting with the reality of that in our own lives and our own darkness can allow a little space, just dropping those ideas about what that is, can make room for that, and that can bring a lot of transformation. We talk a lot about, you know, sort of the appropriate response. So I don't think appropriate response means correct response or right response in the way that we think it means. It's not necessarily right versus wrong, or that's bad, so this is good, or that's wrong and that makes me feel terrible, so this will make me feel good. I think it's the authentic response that comes from being totally present in these circumstances, whatever they are, based on these causes and conditions. You know, dropping away the mind and the body and then responding. And there's not one way to respond. There's a multifaceted, infinite number of ways to respond to things that happen. We do have that choice. You know, I spent a lot of time beating myself up over how I responded to my mother's death. She died when I was 19. So I was relatively young, but I was in college. I was on my own. And I didn't have this practice, and I didn't have what I felt like was a lot of support. So I really pushed it away, the grief and the loss, and I really tried to smother it through a lot of maybe denial. And, you know, I just didn't have a way to make space for that, for myself to be comfortable with it. But I also think after going through a lot of that, it did lead me to this practice, and I'm really grateful for it. Another thing I think that we can talk about being outside of a circle is just something that we haven't experienced before. So we have ideas about it in our head, but we don't know what the real experience is. I've been a part of our village Zendo Sangha that goes up to Sing Sing and sits with prisoners for quite a few years. And it really transformed the way I think about the whole prison system. But you know, mostly just because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't have any idea what being inside a maximum security prison was gonna be like. And I'm sure I had ideas about criminals and prisoners and the horribleness of everything. But actually going up into Sing Sing and sitting and just being with those guys that are there to practice made me realize they're human beings just like us. There's nothing different. It's pretty common just to go and normal, once you get past the fact that you're in the prison, to sit with them. So one of the guys that's been practicing for years, that's in Sing Sing, I think he did 20 years, but he's been in there coming every week or every other week for years to sit. He just got released. So we might see him here. And Rio had a FaceTime call with him. You know, he's back, he's up in Washington Heights. And he reported back to us and he said, his name, he goes by Audi, the guy who got out. He said he's actually grateful for the time that he spent in prison. Of course, he's grateful to be out. But, you know, he he feels like the people that came to visit him and the people who sat with him are family. And that he just learned so much there. He got an education, he took classes, got into yoga. I think he has a couple master's degrees. It was an experience that he never would have had in his regular life. I'm sure it wasn't necessarily the experience he expected to have in prison. So I think, you know, that's where we just need to let that element of not knowing in when we're facing something that's really uncomfortable. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't have an opinion about something. We have to have opinions and we have to function. But if we can just allow that not knowing element, I think it can be very transformational. Things don't always work out the way we think they're supposed to work out. But I think if we're not so absolutely sure about everything, then what does happen can be a surprise. There's a Buddhist scholar and environmental activist named Joanna Macy. And she happens to be considered also one of the world's greatest translators of the poet Rainer Maria Rilke. She's a Rilke scholar. So she translates Rilke, and she's written a lot of books, and I think she wrote a book, it's like a year of Rilke, and it's every day it's a poem of his or something about him or a letter. And I actually just love the way she talks about him, just after studying him, his work and his life for so long. She says, his grasp of the transient nature of all things is critical to his capacity to praise and to cherish. In the face of impermanence and death, it takes courage to love the things of this world and to believe that praising them is our noblest calling. Rilke's is not a conditional courage dependent on an afterlife, nor is it a stoic courage, keeping a stiff upper lip when shattered by loss. It is courage born of the ever unexpected discovery that acceptance of mortality yields an expansion of being. In naming what is doomed to disappear, naming the way it keeps streaming through our hands, we can hear the song that streaming makes. She says, his capacity to embrace the dark and to acknowledge loss brings comfort to the reader because nothing of life is left out. So, it's not totally closed. There's a little space right there. It's very imperfect. There's nothing that cannot be redeemed, she says about his poetry, and his point of view. No degree of hopelessness, such as that of prisoners, beggars, abandoned animals, or inmates of asylums, is outside the scope of the poet's respectful attention. Rilke would like to teach us to accept death as well as life, and in so doing to recognize that they belong together as two halves of the same circle. So for me, our Zazen practice helps us ask, can we be our own poets? Can we make room for the other side of the coin? Can we examine the flip side and acknowledge the darkness in order to appreciate the light? I'm just going to end with a poem from Rilke called Go to the Limits of Your Longing. God speaks to each of us as he makes us, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear. You, sent out beyond your recall, go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like a flame and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you. Beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is the country they call life. You will know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand.